Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And what a lovely spring it's been.
Yes.
It really has.
It has been.
It has been. And as inspiring as the spring is, we've turned our microphones, how's that, to the mountains of North Carolina, where the native azaleas, rhododendrons, and mountain laurels find their home most contently. But we've got them in our garden as well, so we wanted to find out the real scoop on how to make sure that these plants do well.
Yeah, I've planted in the last couple of years, I've planted some native azaleas and some mountain laurels or kalmia, and I just love them. I much prefer them to the more gaudy, almost bawdy. Yeah,
the deciduous and the evergreen
that you
ones,
see along people's houses and yards and stuff. They kind of shout at you.
Yeah.
And these others are more elegant. The natives really are much more elegant by nature. And this, Jamie Oxley knows a lot about these things. He'll tell us the difference between a lot of these plants that people don't know, including me to some extent.
Yeah.
So we're all going to learn something about this.
Yeah, and what we need to do to make sure that we've got a good environment for them as well.
Right.
Yeah, Jamie's from Meadowbrook Nursery, and we do natives in Marion, North Carolina. So, you know, he's right in the middle of it. And then we're going to go out to Oldham County and visit Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve. Our friend Tavia Cathcart is in charge out there now. I think a lot of people don't really know much about this place. Relatively new in the larger scheme of things.
Yeah.
In I think 1970s, they started to kind of plant their forest out. But there's a lot of exciting things going on out there under her watch.
Yeah, and Tavia wrote a book, we had her on a couple of years ago, I think, about wildflowers of Tennessee and I guess southern Kentucky. She knows her stuff, and we'll just explore the place and explain to people what's out there and learn ourselves, really.
Yeah, because we've never been out there either. So
exactly.
That'll be coming up in part two. We're going to hit the road and head out there in Oldham County. Bob, what is going on in your garden in the meantime?
It's booming. This is like the second spring in a row. I guess the wet weather we had in May and April. It just grows like 2 feet a year. Jeez, my house gets smaller and my space between the trees gets smaller, and I love it. I got so much shade now I didn't have before. So that's generally it. One thing I noticed this spring, it seemed to me that the dogwood colors weren't as bright or didn't last as long. I don't know what...
You know, and some people have commented about how some of their dogwoods didn't even bloom at all.
Yeah.
And not to cop out, but I do believe last year was such a hard season.
Exactly.
With, you know, heat and drought... Yeah. And the wind and all this stuff that, and previous years as well, and then that hard freeze that we had a couple years ago, all of that stuff adds up, you all, and it can cause stress for certain plants, so they don't always bloom that well.
And I wonder about the 80-mile-an-hour winds, if that at some point would affect the buds.
It had to have.
Yeah.
Desiccation sure affected is desiccation,
me.
No kidding.
That.
Yeah.
And finally, my carnivorous plants are doing so well, I'm just a proud papa like you are with your chickens. My pitcher plants and my Venus flytraps, they're alive and they're growing and they're, as soon as the
they're eating insects like my chickens are eating insects.
Exactly.
You're right. They're exactly the same.
I've got them in little containers. It's a controlled situation, but just a glorious spring. How about the Wishy State?
Well, a note about all the rain that we've had that has helped with the glorious spring, to be sure, but it can also, you know, keep an eye out on some of your plants. And it just goes back to the whole thing of preparing your soil well and making sure you've got good drainage. Because if you've got soggy areas, some plants are going to suffer from that. Some of our perennial beds are kind of clay and soggy. So whenever we have a rainy spring, Bob, those plants end up getting, like there's some veronicas and stuff. Yeah. They end up getting, start to yellow out from too much water, no oxygen, nutrients just being washed away. And then once that happened, they're stunted for the rest of the season. So if that happens, don't be totally freaked out because it's probably just due to all the rain that we had, particularly if it's not in a well-drained situation. And here's a story for you.
It's pretty gross,
and it's just a reminder for everybody
because of
how rainy it's been.
Yeah.
So we have the little chicken compost pile, right?
Uh-oh.
Where the poop goes.
I may leave the room on this one.
And when it rains like this, you really got to turn your compost pile a little more often than normal. So we're in there in the garden, go to turn that. And it was not a healthy compost pile is all I want to say.
Yeah.
And it was because it was just so waterlogged. If you have a compost pile, make sure when it rains like this that you turn it definitely once a week.
Are you going to post photos on the website?
No. It doesn't look as gross as it smells because it wasn't that healthy compost, active. It was rotting. So we're trying to restore the health of we've spread it out, and, you know, we're in...
Yeah, something else I did this spring that may have been wrong, but what else are you going to do? I got all kinds of flats of annuals to plant, and it was really, honestly, too wet to plant. On the other hand, I only had a certain amount of time to plant, so I kind of muttered them in, as I call it, and I'm praying for dry now. I don't recommend that, but
sometimes... No, but sometimes that's what
happens.
What
are you going to do? Yeah. What are you going
to
do?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how well they do.
I'll put those pictures on the website.
Okay. I'll show you my rotting compost pile. You show me your dead annuals. All right. What's going on around town, Bob? Let's see. We have, actually, this sounds pretty cool. The weekend of May 29th through the 31st in Dawson Spring, Kentucky, the Pennyryle Forest State Resort Park is going to host its first Gardening for Birds and Butterflies.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty cool, yeah. Yep. There's a registration fee, but, you know, participants get to do a whole bunch of cool stuff, creating a backyard haven for birds and butterflies, etc. So check out our website for more information, or get in touch with the Pennyryle Forest State Resort Park for more information as well. But our website, of course, is wfpl.org. And the farmers markets are continuing to open around town. The St. Matthews Farmers Market is now open. They are in St. Matthews at the Beargrass Christian Church. So on Saturdays, you can check that out. Pretty much every corner of our community has a farmers market now.
And finally, the first annual Nature Fest at Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve. Just a great event from 12 to 4 p.m. on May 30th. Live bands and dancing and food and tours, all sorts of things. But we'll find out more about that later, because we're going to visit with the executive director out there later in the show.
All right, Bob, on to fabulous woodland flowering shrubs. Jamie Oxley's joining us. Jamie runs the family business of Meadowbrook Nursery, and We Do Natives, where they retail and mail order native plants, including rhododendrons, azaleas, and mountain laurels. Jamie, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, Jamie, a little background first, because this is a question I ask myself and don't even know the difference. We talk about kalmia and native azaleas and, of course, the domesticated azaleas and the rhododendron. What's the difference between those four plants, if any?
Well, we're all going to start with the fact that we're in plant family Ericaceae.
Okay.
And they're ericaceous plants. And believe it or not, it also includes blueberries and sourwood trees. And wintergreen, Gulf apricumbens, other little things people don't know. And within that, it's kind of like saying we're all Smiths. Well, we're all related, but I'm not related to the same Smiths that are up, that are over the branch here somewhere.
Okay.
Within that, when we get to mountain laurels, we have Kalmia latifolia. And Kalmia latifolia is our native mountain laurel. It is it's always evergreen, usually a mid-sized leaf, and has usually a white to a pink bloom. The nice thing about them is they hold the buds for a long time before they finally open with a real multitude of tiny flowers. And the native ones are white. And then we grow a lot of the selected cultivars, Kaleidoscope, Bullseye, Pristine, that have been bred. A lot of them have been bred by Dr. Dick James up in the Northeast.
Right.
Then we move into rhododendrons. And this is what really confuses everybody.
Right.
All azaleas are rhododendrons. Not all rhodies are azaleas. And so when we've got evergreen rhododendrons, we've got big leaf types and little leaf types.
Right.
Both still in bloom right now. Fabulous, evergreen, wide variety of foliage. We've got a good many of them native to our area of western North Carolina. We've got the Rose Bay, or the Rhododendron Maximum, which blooms in July, usually, and it blooms in the shade, which is nice. We've also got Rhododendron Carolinianum, which is a smaller leafed, smaller ball truss rhododendron, and a lot of people are familiar with the PJM-type rhododendron.
Right.
That you might have around there, and that is, Carolinianum is one of the parents of PJM type.
And what's PJM stand for?
Phyllis Jean Mezzett, I believe.
Okay.
Out of the Mezzett nurseries, out of the Western nurseries, I believe it was named after one of the spouses of the founders of Western nurseries in Massachusetts.
Okay. So Jamie, the smaller leaf rhododendron, do they typically bloom a little bit earlier than those larger leaves?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And not as...
They sure do. They bloom earlier. And then we move into the Catalbianth hybrids. And the Catalbianth hybrids are what are also native around here. And they're the ones that are the most common for a lot of the big leaves rhododendrons that bloom. They're the most common and a lot of them are using the hybrids of English Roseum, or Roseum elegans is one of the most familiar ones that people know, and a lot of the other hybrids.
And those would be the ones that when somebody around here thinks of a rhododendron, that's what pops into their head.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the azalea and rhododendron, explain the difference.
And now we're getting into the fact, the evergreen azaleas that so many people know that are so pretty, they are not native to North America or to the United States.
Okay, so that's the distinction.
Mostly oriental. Then we have our deciduous azaleas that are native to North Carolina. There are roughly 16 species of them that grow here, and so many of them occur, almost all of them occur along the East Coast, with the exception of the Occidentale, which only occurs out on the West Coast and doesn't grow well here. In Kentucky, you've got the Cumberland azalea, native to your area up there, and then you have lots of other ones, flame azaleas, different, so many different ones of those. But these are the azaleas that are going to come out really bright blooms. Some bloom before the leaves come out, some bloom after the leaves come out.
Okay, but they're all, the natives are deciduous.
Yes, they are.
All right.
Now, is there a distinction between azaleas and rhododendrons then?
Most, they're all called rhododendron, genus rhododendron, species, whatever they are. So the distinction most people make are that evergreen rhododendrons, for the most part, have the big leaves that stay on them year round.
Okay, so where did the word azalea come from then? Why even like muck it up with something altogether, you know what I mean?
I don't know the exact meaning of the word is right. Where it came from. I'm thinking it came from Oriental, and I'm not a good wordsmith, so I don't know that. It has been very confusing, but it's the reason we have all this Latin, and sometimes when people come to the nursery, they're like, oh, don't throw that Latin at me. I'm like, but it lets me talk with someone from Japan about plants.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure that we're on the same page. So,
but generally speaking, we can say the rhododendrons are the larger leaf, the evergreen, more broadleaf evergreen, and then the azaleas are the smaller leaf, whether they're evergreen or deciduous.
That's very good.
Okay.
And they're all rhododendrons.
They're all rhododendrons, they're all however. Rhododendrons.
Okay.
All right, Jamie, we're going to kind of switch the focus to Kalmia latifolia, or the mountain laurel. All of these sort of have a similar profile, if you will, right? So if we were to go into the mountains of North Carolina or visit your nursery, what kind of perfect growing environment do these flowering mountain plants like?
Filtered sunlight. I always tell people one of the biggest clues is go and look and see where you natively occur, see them occur and growing. Usually you'll see them in well-drained soils on slopes, and that slope is just really key to letting people know the soil needs to be well-drained. You don't see them growing in a ditch at the bottom. You'll see other plants growing in a ditch somewhere, but not an ericaceous plant, or especially not a mountain laurel or an azalea or rhododendron. So they like an acid soil that's well-drained. They would love to have up to 5 hours a day of sunlight, but they don't want that hot afternoon sun. Here in the South, I call it the afternoon bake.
We got that here, too.
The southwestern side of most people's yard is usually just really tough. That's that beaten down sun. So they can handle up to a half day sun, but they would much rather it be in the morning so that they've got a little bit of respite in the afternoon from the conditions, and it can cool off a little bit.
So, Jamie, is it fair to say that many of those understory, you know, filtered mountain plants, the fact that they do like acid soil, is it just the nature of the beast that wooded floor, that forest floor, so to speak, is going to be acid?
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
You've got leaves that have been breaking down and naturally composting themselves. My grandmother was, I love it, my grandmother was my garden trainer, and she used to make me go out in the woods and get woods dirt whenever we were planting corn.
Wow.
I'd get Bill Bear's woods dirt. Now we call it amending the soil.
Right.
But it was the same thing. We're inoculating that soil a little bit with some of the mycorrhizae. We're increasing drainage. Usually you don't see low spots, so that compost is increasing drainage. We're bringing in some of that natural fauna in there that's going to help the root systems grow. So
compost your leaves and...
My key for success, that I've been my mantra for success with these plants for years, has first been do not plant too deeply times 10 to the billionth power. Most people plant too deeply. There's nothing wrong with the very top edge of that root ball being exposed a little bit because you're going to dig your hole 1.5 times wider, but no deeper.
Mm-hmm.
I like to recommend, and this is a point of contention, but I like to recommend removing the native soil, replacing it with a mixture of soil conditioner, something like Nature's Helper or soil conditioner, 3 parts of that to 1 part of mushroom compost.
Mm-hmm.
Backfill that planting hole. Then you want a nice layer of mulch on top, up to 3 inches. And here in the South, we have a good bit of double ground hardwood mulch, is what I like to recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And that mulch acts as not only your, it acts as your insulation for your root zone. If you can keep those roots from getting too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter, you're going to have happy plants.
Okay.
You're also going to retain a lot of moisture.
So you're just basically trying to mimic that.
That woodland
floor,
condition that you just spoke of, you
mm-hmm.
got it just right to a T, and then creating our woodland garden. So it's pretty easy to have success with these plants in your garden, but you do have to mimic the woodland garden just as you described it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's hope for the subdivision souls who had their soil destroyed, provided you prepared first, because I see these things in nurseries other people do, and they're just blown away by the flowers, and they take them home, stick them in clay, and it's history. So it can happen.
It can happen, and drainage really, I go back to what I said earlier, when you see them naturally occurring, you don't see them at the bottom of a slope, you see them on a hillside. And so that's your giveaway that you can take from nature. They go, they like well-drained soil.
Okay, Jamie, Kalmia latifolia, the mountain laurel. I've got several in my garden. I think Bob has some, but you don't really see them as widespread, you know, as you all would in North Carolina. So can you describe to our listeners kind of what's the standout for the mountain laurel?
It has a very glossy leaf. I like to say they're going to be in the garden around 4 feet tall by about 4 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
A very shiny evergreen leaf, real nice shine to it. Probably the best thing I like about them is the buds, regardless of, we've got a lot of name variety. We have Bullseye, Kaleidoscope, Ostabo Red, Carol, Sarah, Meteor, and Olympic Fire, I think, are the ones that we're growing this year, in addition to the native mountain laurels. But the nice thing that I love about them is you get the buds for a long time, maybe up to a month. Buds will show.
And they're pretty showy themselves, right?
And it's such a great harbinger of spring. You're like, it's coming. Hang on. Summer coming. And I'm like you. I think they're really pretty. And then when you open up the flower, you almost get a color change.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the year, nice evergreen, deep foliage.
Okay. So in terms of, you know, maintaining them, would you prune similarly as we would with azaleas and rhododendrons right after they finish blooming? Or is it one of those plants really that you don't ever need to prune if you don't have to?
I think that you do have to prune them, and pruning time is critical. It definitely needs to be exactly as you said, right after they bloom. And what we found is in the nursery containers, they grow so fast, we have to prune them several times, so it's always hard for us to get them to bloom in the containers. That's why you don't see them in bloom in garden centers a lot, because they do grow, and we tend to nip them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you get it in the garden, it depends on how you want it to grow as to how much pruning. A lot of these hybrid types, they tend to be a little moundier and a little lower and more free-flowing to the ground. And I think so much of it depends on your individual garden taste on how you want it to grow. If you want it to be larger, you're going to have to prune the sides on it a little bit to make it increase the center to gain a little height, or you can just let it go and be a nice mounding shrub.
Now, you ship, 1 gallon containers, and how long will it take to get them to 4 or 5 feet?
Our favorite, we ship 1 and 2 gallon containers. Because this question's been asked, I planted some here at the nursery, and the time lag, it's not the fastest or the slowest growing plant. Time lag on that one to get to be 4 or 5 feet is probably going to be 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fair.
No.
One of my sort of issues is, or thoughts rather, assumptions, how about that, is that the mountain laurel, given where, you know, it likes to grow, it doesn't particularly like our hot, humid summers here in Kentuckiana. Is that indeed the case, or Jamie, are there particular cultivars that are a little bit more heat tolerant?
Key to success with that plant is the root systems on these, all these plants, the azaleas, the rhodies, the mountain laurels, they have a very shallow root system. You can go out in the woods and
right.
You can have one 5 feet tall and it has a small root system. The key you're going to have to do is amend your soil, create that woodland garden condition that we talked about earlier.
Okay.
And make sure during that first year of establishment, those roots cannot dry out.
Okay.
They like cool, moist roots, but they don't want standing water.
So keep the roots cool, not necessarily the ambient air
exactly.
issue. Okay.
Keep those roots happy, and you can do this. There's a variety that we grow called Pristine.
Mm-hmm.
We have customers all the way into Louisiana and all over Georgia that are successfully growing it. And it came from Woodlander's Nursery, actually outside of Columbia, South Carolina. So it came from a very hot, almost sandy, very similar to conditions to what you are, mm-hmm. but a little more sandy. So mm-hmm. it is adaptable. You will see it natively occurring in some warm regions, but you just have to create that microclimate within your yard.
Jimmy, what's going on with the propagation in the Kalmia field?
Kalmia is one of those that is just darn near impossible to root. All of our plants and most of the mountain laurels that you see are produced by tissue culture. And that's a form of micropropagation. And Kalmia do not root well at all. We do grow some of our natives from seed, but most of 99% of all Kalmia in the marketplace are grown from a micropropagation method called tissue culture.
So do you have a tissue culture area set up at the nursery there?
No, we don't. We okay. work with nurseries. Most of the tissue culture labs are in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
And we work with labs both in Washington and Oregon that do a great job, and we put our orders in advance, and then they ship us small plantlets that then we grow off.
Jamie, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Enjoy being on.
All right. Jamie Oxley runs Meadowbrook Nursery in We Do Natives in Marion, North Carolina. The nurseries propagate and retail a large collection of native and hybrid azaleas, rhododendrons, and mountain laurels. Of course, for more information on the nursery and the plants, please go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, a trip out to the Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And Miss Wishy, we are sitting on the porch of the Mahan Manor at the Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve.
Very good.
There's grass in front of us, acres of rolling fields, big maple trees. We've just spent an hour walking through incredible hiking trails to a wonderful waterfalls at a place nobody knows anything about, and we're going to change that
That's right now. And I think that this place is on the cusp of a rebirth. And Tavia Cathcart is the newly appointed executive director about a year now, right, Tavia?
That's right. I'm so happy that you all are here.
Yeah. So give us first a little, I mean, why is it that nobody knows about the place, first of all? But give us first a background on the Creasy Mahan, the people themselves, how this place came to be a nature preserve and, you know, what's going on.
It's a wonderful little story. Virginia Creasy Mahan was married to Howard Mahan. And in fact, Howard Mahan was her stockbroker. And she had him on an allowance. If he made money for her, he got an allowance. So Virginia Creasy Mahan was really the one in charge of the money.
Mm-hmm.
And Virginia Creasy Mahan passed away in 1975. But before she passed away, she made sure that in her will that she and Howard Mahan had a foundation and that they would turn this beautiful 168-acre land into a nature preserve.
So there were no children involved, no like significant extended family, so they felt the best thing to do was to give it to the community, if you were.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Well, Tavy, we're about 25 miles north of Louisville in Goshen Prospect area, not too far from the river, but there's a photo of this place inside the house when the family moved here. It was nothing but pasture from here to the Ohio River.
Well, if I can, one thing that's neat to think about is before they were here, in the early days, all of this land historically was beautiful old growth forest. And this would be in the mid-1770s when people were starting to move here, and in the early 1800s when the early pioneers were coming. And this was just rolling hills, beautiful old growth forest, lots of birds and lots of mammals. And then as the pioneers and the settlers came, just by necessity alone, they had to cut the trees down. And they used it for fuel, of course. And they cut the trees down because they needed the pasture land. They needed the land for agricultural purposes. So then it became the pasture land that you saw in the photographs inside. Mm-hmm. And is what Creasy Mayan Nature Preserve was when Virginia and Howard were living here. Now, what's a neat thing is the visionary couple, when they decided to leave it as the nature preserve, they then worked with the local entities and the federal entities to turn this into the beautiful forest that it is. They planted 43,000 trees and shrubs in the 70s.
Yeah, like let's give in the 1970s, let's get, you know, give us some context here. You know, it seems like such a long history to the place, but in fact, the Mahans moved here in the 20s, and in fact, he lived until the 1980s, but they started to plant in 1970 these new forests. So now we've got 35-year-old forests, but things were a little bit amiss with that too. So what are your challenges today, Tavia, in terms of managing what was started back in the 70s and then improving on it?
Well, what happened back then is the government suggested that they plant autumn olive and bush honeysuckle. And as many of the listeners probably know, these are not things that we want in our forests today. In fact, autumn olive was planted because they thought that would be good for deer and good forage and good bedding plants for deer and other animals, and in fact it's not. It has very limited use for our wildlife today. So what we're actively doing is we have a government grant to actually remove these exact same species that were planted in the 70s. We've already removed 7 acres. We have another 107 more to go, basically. But in the areas where we've already removed the invasive non-native species, the native flowers are already coming back. They are forming just acres of beautiful spring wildflowers that probably laid dormant for 20, 30, 50 years. We don't know. But these seeds were hibernating until the perfect environment came to be, which is where we're at today.
Yeah, we just walked along the trail, seeing a lot of those wildflowers. Give us some specific plants that we just saw and why you like them so much.
Well, even before you all came today, we had acres of yellow trout lilies. What we saw today, remnants of, that had just finished flowering, we saw twin leaf. We saw Jack and Jill in the pulpits.
This is rock group, isn't it?
We saw beautiful specimens. We probably saw a Jack in the pulpit that was probably 20 years old, really old. And the neatest flower that is under-heralded is the green violet that grows on the calcium rocky slopes we saw today. We also saw lots of native spice bush shrubs, so wonderful. And we also have larkspur that we didn't see today, but that will be flowering soon.
There's also some fabulous natural springs and some waterfalls that if you really, you know, go back the trails, and what you've got about 8 miles worth of trails, if you really go back and explore, you can really find some gems of plants, but also just these natural formations. So the natural springs, about how many do you have on the property, and how many water features, if you will, natural do you all have?
We have 4 year-round springs that are gushers. I mean, they just feed our property. They have what I call, they're the heart of our property, really. Before us right now, we have one of our springs, and then back in the forest, we have the 3 year-round springs. And if I could just kind of describe how we have the front 57-acre that you referred to as manicured, rolling, grassy areas. We also, the forested part with the paths, we have a little bit over 111 acres. We call that our wildlife refuge because, in fact, since we're surrounded by suburbs, the wildlife, the animals and the birds who live here don't have anywhere else to go. This is a sanctuary, so to speak, for the animals and birds.
You're going to have an event here May 30th. We'll talk about this later from noon to 4. People can come out here and see these things and walk these trails, but Over to our left, there's kind of an open field that you're going to convert to wildflowers, and one of your specialties, and Janine did the same thing at her place, so tell us your plans for that field over there.
It is really exciting, and Janine and I, we have a lot to share, I think, because for many of us in the local area who are trying to convert what is mostly a fescue field into native grasses and wildflowers, it's a really exciting and a plan, and I have a 7-year plan for this because it takes a long time to really eradicate the non-native grasses into the native grasses. So we're real excited about it. It's adjacent to an area where we're converting an old pond area into it's going to be a beautiful stream waterfall, and it's eventually going to be a 3-pond area right above our little native spring here. I'm doubling up the wildflower seeds so that the community can enjoy it and really enjoy the summer flowering species.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges that most people face these days, of course, is the financing of these sorts of endeavors. I know that you'd sort of mentioned the baby steps in terms of just continuing to add on to the Nature Preserve's collection thus far. So is there an endowment that allows you all to continue to do your work, or are you in fact faced with many challenges just like everybody else?
I'd say it's a little bit of both. We have the foundation that Virginia, Creasy Mahan, and Howard Mahan left us, but it has severely dwindled and been affected by the economic downturn, of mm-hmm. course. So part of me being here is to fundraise. We have basically dwindling resources with a goal to actually support more people and connect more people with nature. We have thousands and thousands of visitors every year, even for our tiny little spot. Not only the locals who like to come here to dog walk and run and walk and have a time of meditation and a connection with nature, but we support thousands of educational thousands of children who enjoy our environmental ed and biological science programs. Mm-hmm. And so the need has never been greater mm-hmm. with the funds the lowest. So, and of course I have lots of ideas, and I want to bring many new gardens and people who appreciate flowers to the Nature Preserve. So yes, I am fundraising.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, at this point, I think, okay, schools, that's been tapped into, and, you know, the locals know that it's here, and they utilize it for walking and other things and picnics, and there's some playing fields that are associated with some of the local schools around here as well. But essentially, it's an untapped resource. So how do you feel, or what are some of the ideas to try to really draw people out this way that may not have otherwise, you know, known about it?
Well, I think we are unique in that we have a 200-year-old manor, we have a 200-year-old spring house, as well as the beautiful grounds. And so what we're really trying to do is we're starting off with a new nature festival, and it's a celebration of nature and community. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to let the broader community and region know not only about our beautiful place, but to celebrate our local mom and pop makers of jewelry and jams and jellies. We're going to have flint knappers. Mm-hmm. We're going to have woodworkers and wood carvers. We're going to have people who will be, of course, face painting, all the fun things that kids love and adults love. We're going to have Bernheim volunteers. We're trying to pull together our local environmental groups as well. So we're going to have Bernheim volunteers leading forest walks. We're going to have river fields here to talk about how we can protect our waterways, as well as our own wonderful resource teachers mm-hmm. and wildflower specialists leading walks. We're going to have music, and we're going to have I call it a big picnic party. We're going to have bluegrass and jazz. We're also having the Louisville Country Dancers, 20 of them, come with a call and response. I could go on and on. Please, do you have any more questions?
Well, just one. I think a friend of mine named Albert Nelson, a wonderful local sculptor, works with children quite a bit. He's going to create a children's fountain out here. Is that correct?
That's right. That's so neat that you brought that up. We're at Goshen Animal Clinic, who is one of the sponsors for Nature Fest on May 30th. Goshen Animal Clinic is actually commissioning him to make a pet and animal fountain. And we're going to have kids come, and they're going to work with him to chip out the stone. And we're hoping sometime later this summer to unveil the pet fountain.
And where will that be located? In one of your new gardens?
Well, it's going to be right behind one. It's going to be between the field house and our nature center and the Mahan Manor. It's going to be a main gathering spot. And we're going to have one of our wonderful Eagle Scouts is going to build a little gazebo right next door.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, the neat part about volunteers and the Scouts, you can walk on the trails and around the property and see all kinds of things that have been built by your Eagle Scouts, whether it's a gazebo or a bench or a bridge across one of those, is it Little Huckleberry Stream?
That, I love that.
That goes through.
Little Huckleberry Creek. Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. And most of our benches were built by Eagle Scouts. We have a beautiful butterfly garden by a Girl Scout who did it for a Gold Award project. And we have a brand new kind of demonstration garden going in by a Gold Award Girl Scout. I don't know what we would do without our Eagle Scouts and Girl Scouts. They really help us.
Are there other volunteers? Do you have a staff that is a full-time staff that's helping get some of this stuff done?
We're as big as we are. We only have a 3-person full-time staff, and we really rely on volunteers, and we're actively recruiting new volunteers who want to get their hands dirty in the gardens, and anyone who passes by who might want to donate bulbs or donate plants from their garden. We accept all of it. We'll drive out in our old donated pickup truck. We'll even dig them up. But we're definitely putting in perennial gardens, and I want to line the long driveway up to the old manor with exotic daylilies and perennials. And we have our hands out, not only for money, but for volunteers and flowers, anything anyone wants to give. It's a great spot with a lot of potential.
Tavy, we also stopped by a pond out back that had some frogs in it and a little history that's all its own.
That's right. Of course, now Virginia Creasy Mahan loved horses. This was her baby. She raised horses throughout, and so historically we have a few spots where we had horse ponds, probably started as cattle ponds, not landscaped at all, just a little
drinking hole.
A drinking hole, a dip in the earth. Well, and so we still have one. We've renamed it to be a frog pond, and it's actively used by our kids on our environmental ed class field trips. We come out there, we get our little nets, we lift up, and we grab what we see, and we show them. We study each little tadpole. We look at the egg masses. We have lots of painted turtles. We have sliders. We have many species of frogs in there, American toads, the birds and bats at night actively use our frog pond, and we have little benches built by our wonderful Eagle Scouts and a nice informational educational sign.
And just beyond that, I have to say, I would love to have one of these podiums. You've actually built an outdoor classroom, you know, with fallen timbers, and actually crafted out of a stump a fabulous podium with a little notch area so that your notes wouldn't slide off or anything.
Well, I have to tell you, that outdoor classroom, I had wanted to put one in, and then the windstorm hit us. Mm-hmm. And we had about 1,000 trees damaged or downed. And Mike Huff is our buildings and grounds manager, and he's quite creative. And he saw what I wanted, and he put it together. And the stump with the podium, that's now a podium, with the roots and all, actually didn't belong there. Uh-huh. He brought it in, and he carved it and made it into a little podium and a little rock step up to it. Mm-hmm. And Julie Patterson, who's our resource and programs manager, she's in charge of all of our classes. She immediately saw the potential for that. Mm-hmm. And the three of us just make that happen. The kids go crazy. They climb all over those logs, and the teachers love it. And pretty soon we're going to be adding native plants around it, donated by Margaret Shea from Drop Seed Nursery. And so we'll be making that into a real active, experiential classroom for kids, and really turning it into something that's magical and beautiful.
So it sounds like you've got a lot of collaboration with many of the what we can consider sort of institutions around town, you know, from Bernheim to Udell. You know, are there other sort of connections that you'd like to make that could sort of fast forward some of the plantings, sure, but also just that educational experience that people can get, you know, connecting with nature out here?
Well, really, the main thing is to let the local community know about us. It's amazing how Literally, people who might only live a mile away don't know about our little spot. Mm-hmm. Since we're not on a major road, it's easy to drive by and not be aware that we're here. So my main goal is really to connect with garden societies mm-hmm. in the area, both Louisville and Oldham County, and to let the community know that we're here and that not only are we a beautiful resource for them, but they need to know we are a nonprofit. Many people who come through here because of the library being on our property and the playground think that we're actually a city park. I have people all the time who think I work for the county. Mm-hmm. When I say I run this place, they say, oh, you work for the county. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they don't know that we're actually a nonprofit private property foundation, and we need their support just to stay as beautiful as we are today, to keep this place going. Mm-hmm. We could really use people's help.
We don't need any more subdivisions.
No, we don't. No, all the animals really need us. You know, they get chased out and they come over here, and we want to keep this place healthy with as many natives as possible and keep the trails up. Since I've been here, we put in 2.5 miles of trails, and it's a delicate balance between putting in a new trail and keeping habitat for the animals mm-hmm. as well.
Well, it looks like you're doing a good job so far. Good luck.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to have you all out here. Thanks for coming.
Tavia Cathcart is the very enthusiastic executive director of the Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve, which is located just off Kentucky 1793 and US 42. For more information on the preserve or the upcoming May 30th Nature Fest, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here with some questions.
Yes, fresh from the Nature Preserve.
You ready to answer one?
Yeah.
This one's interesting, and it goes to a lot of things that's wrong with the world.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, right. Another Bob rant coming up. Well, he saw in a science magazine, a man named Alan, an article, an ad for zoysia grass. Mm-hmm. The ad said it needed less watering, it thrives in blistering heat, excellent for slopes, reduces mowing to once a month, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, chokes out weeds, flies the sky, cuts costs and chemicals, grows thick like a soft carpet, and did not mention, of course, it's an ugly yellow all winter.
Yeah.
Among other things. So, Miss Wishy, what's your thought on zoysia grass as a lawn replacement?
Not here. If you have a golf course or you have a high traffic area in a municipal place in, you know, say, Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. But zoysia grass is not at all a good grass for us in Kentucky. Your best bet is to stick with tall-type fescues. So
yeah, it'll also be in your neighbor's yard if you're not careful.
Yeah, it's almost like Bermuda grass, and it's just not right.
Exactly.
So there. And I think most people agree with
me. So much for the zoysia grass.
So much for the zoysia grass. Okay, yeah. Here is a question from Andy in Borden, Indiana.
Hoosiers.
Hoosiers. Yay, I love those Hoosiers. Love your show. My wife and Gwen and I listen every Sunday. Thank you, Andy. I have a pile of old lumber from a deck that was torn down. It has been sitting around for about 5 years, partially covered. It appears to be treated wood. It still is in relatively good shape. My question is, can I use the wood to make raised beds in our vegetable garden?
Probably not a good idea. More recently, the treated lumber isn't as toxic to humans or animals or pets or anything else. It's got better chemicals in it.
I think it's like pressure-treated and not arsenic-treated, basically.
Yeah, the old stuff did have some chemicals that are not healthy for the body, so I wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't do it either, yeah.
Right.
And I think primarily it was arsenic that they used to use, isn't it? And lead-based,
who knows?
Chromiated lead, something or other. Like kids would get sick, lead poisoning or something.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't. No. We're downers, aren't we? No to zoysia, and no to old treated wood.
Well, here's an upper, perhaps.
Okay.
Bill calls. He heard that drilling holes and pouring buttermilk into old tree stumps would accelerate the decay process by attracting insects to eat it away. Is this true or an old wives' tale?
I've never heard this before. Have you?
No. I've used buttermilk, I heard, for growing moss.
Yeah, you can, like, Cuisinart up buttermilk and moss and then spread it on stuff to make more
moss. I've never tried
moss.
That either, but it's, people...
My mom did once.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Okay, that didn't work either.
Okay, so I've never heard of that, so I have absolutely no idea, but I'm all game for trying things as long as it's not like a dreadful chemical. It's buttermilk. And I would think that, you know, Bob, there's 1% buttermilk, and then there's like whole fat, full fat buttermilk.
Yep, yep.
I'd opt for the full fat buttermilk because the fat may stick around a little longer to attract ants and other things that might expedite your decay.
I was thinking peanut butter. But actually, drilling holes is probably a good idea, mm-hmm. or taking a chainsaw and cutting holes, because any exposure to the atmosphere and insects mm-hmm. will accelerate the decay, but it's still going to take many, many years,
yeah.
depending on the stump.
I think we had a stump that finally broke away just last year, and it was a stump that had been around probably for 12 to 13 years.
Wow.
So there.
It's a long time.
Yeah, maybe I should try the buttermilk.
Yeah. Well, if you want to stump Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page with your questions at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
It is a plant story, Bob. What do you have for us?
It's all your fault.
Is it?
Yes.
I hope it's a good one.
It's a great one. We were sitting around the studio last week or two, and you came across the word loosestrife.
Uh-huh.
And you said, Bob,
here's a story for you. It's true, you all.
It turned out it was.
All right.
It was a good story.
So what is it?
Well, one thing, I've called it Lysimachia all my life. It's uh-huh. Lysimachia, according to...
I said Lysimachia,
too. I know. Well, either way.
Yeah, don't trust everything we say, people.
No, for sure. But it's got a very literal meaning. We'll get to this later in Greek. It does mean loose strife, as to end strife. That's how it got named.
Oh, lose,
yeah.
Not loose.
Well, the Greeks.
Okay.
They talked any way they wanted. That's a plant with a reputation both good and bad. One species called vulgaris, which mm-hmm. is, of course, the common one. But what gives it a bad reputation is the purple loosestrife, which mm-hmm. has invaded northern lakes. It's got, each plant can have 2.5 million seeds.
Shoot.
But that's not in the Lysimachia family.
Oh, it's not?
No, that's a Lythrum family. It's a totally different animal.
Oh, that's right.
So it's branded as one of the
more because it's loose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And my favorite loosestrife, the one I have at home a lot, is Lysimachia numularia aurea, or creeping Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
It's named for your mom, I think. it's a very versatile plant. It's, you know, bright yellow, fragrant flowers, wet or dry. It's a ground cover. I use it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like 150 species of Lysimachia. Most of them are pretty quick growers, too, unfortunately.
You're still saying Lysimachia. We'll never shake it.
I know it.
That's okay.
I said it once. And
I know.
Going back, tomato, tomato.
So am I.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm incorrectable here. Anyway, there's a white one, the gooseneck loosestrife. It's real tall.
And it's really pretty, but it can be kind of invasive, too, unless you put it in kind of a crappy area.
But it's three feet taller than creeping Jenny in the same family. That kind mm-hmm. of fascinates me.
Totally different, yeah.
There's the yellow loosestrife. It grows in ditches, called ditch witch, of course.
Cool.
It's got a great history. Lysimachia was named for King Lysimachus mm-hmm. of Thrace,
mm-hmm.
which is now parts of Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Macedonia. You knew that. But it goes back 2,400 years when he was king.
Mm-hmm.
And the name is still with us. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
He's the guy that named it loosestrife for people of the day, farmers, because the story is the king or the farmers would wave a plant of Lysimachia at the enraged ox, and it would pacify them.
Huh.
It would loose their strife. Or end their strife.
Right.
Or as someone wrote at the time, appeasing the strife and unruliness which falleth out among oxen at the plow, if it be put about their yokes.
So it kept them calm while they were working,
yep.
essentially.
And really, Greek Lysa means loosen and Maka means strife.
Cool.
So they got
That's
rid of strife.
That's fabulous.
Came with a poem.
Good.
Oh, who would need a United Nations? The world could live in good vibrations if people would put down gun and knife and carry instead the yellow loosestrife. Even this plant we've labeled vulgaris has something good and right to tell us. It's had the strength to allay our fears, reaching back more than 2,000 years. We don't need anger, threats, or poses, tears, heartbreak, caskets with roses. All along we've had the power to hold up high a yellow flower, to wave it at those who charge our way. Will we ever see that brighter day?
I may have to implement this loose drive to calm the things that surround me.
Yeah, I think Janet's going to have to
get it for
a yard full. Yeah.
All right. Good one, Bob. Thank you very much for explaining loose drive.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to pay another visit to a cool place, Farmington.
Homegrown is produced by the perpetually calm Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.